there's a certain, I think, opinion that romance is only read by women of a certain age who kind of pull it off the shelves in a supermarket and put it in a trolley with their tenor ladies. And so lovely that Dave Myers came out and said, I love Millie Johnson books. I'm not just saying this to brag. What I'm saying is that people are discerning. It's quite possible to read the Sunday Times and enjoy a bit of romance. I mean, my other half said to one of his, is an antiques dealer, he said to one of the other antiques dealers once, they were asking how I was doing. He said, oh yeah, she's number two in the bestseller list. And he said, is that a provincial list? Believe that I was up there, just nudged out down from by Richard Osman in the number one position, you know, because that would not have got on his radar that I, me, could be on the Sunday Times bestseller list at number two.
Welcome to Bestsellers. I'm Natalie Jameson.
I'm Phil Williams.
And today we're talking about lots of things. We're talking about romance. We're talking about male characters. We're talking about snobbery. Lots of things that kind of felt really cathartic, actually, to kind of get off our chest with today's guest.
Now, today's guest is the multi-best-selling Millie Johnson. It's the first time that we've interviewed her, either in Bestsellers or in Radioland, isn't it? I've not interviewed her before, would you?
No, I had met her at a lovely publisher's breakfast thing that happened and knew that she'd be delightful to chat to. And yeah, she absolutely is.
Yeah, she's really funny, really, really funny, really warm and engaging. And if I wasn't about to blurt out to you where she's from, you'd almost certainly guess by the end of this interview that it's Yorkshire.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know that part of the world as well as I should. I've obviously been out there a little bit over the years, but the humour and the warmth and the stories that Millie has to tell are a delight.
But yeah, there's some hugely picturesque parts of Yorkshire that you would love. And obviously hoping that you listening will also love Millie's sense of humour here as much as we did when we chatted to her about her new rom-com. Also, by the way, some very strong views on how rom-coms are treated in the mainstream media. So we'll get to that after Natalie Jameson's done a full and comprehensive introduction.
Millie Johnson took a winding path to being a full-time author. She's always written, whether it was creating jokes for the phenomenally successful Purple Ronnie card franchise, and then later establishing her own joke writing company. But there were many, many jobs in between. Millie got her publishing deal with Simon & Schuster when she was 40 and has spent the 20 years since writing, is that, I think, close to 30 books now, Millie?
It's 21, but they're full-length novels.
Yeah.
But then you've got novelettes and ebook books. So, you know, I only ever count the full-length novels, to be honest. But, yeah, I'm, you know, with works in progress, etc., I'm doing a bit of a count up towards 30, yeah.
I think so. You're definitely doing at least one a year, which is pretty speedy. As far as I can tell, your trademark style is about showing female characters who've got stuck somehow in their lives, and then you show them the way back to where they should be. Your writing is funny and warm, and it centres the power of friendship at its core. Millie Johnson, thank you so much for joining us on Bestsellers.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
So your latest book is The Happiest Ever After. I kind of mention it often, Phil and I kind of tend to go off on tangents before we really get to the book that we're talking about. But I want to mention it first of all, because it is a book in many parts. And I want to be led by you on how much of the story you're prepared to give away up front, because this is a book that kind of takes so many twists and turns that I wasn't expecting. I don't want to blow anything for readers.
Well, it's weird because when I was talking before I'd written it about what it was about, that became the big spoiler. So I thought I better shut up about that, you know. So it is, in effect, because writers sometimes get jade, as it were, and we need to stretch ourselves. There are a million books out there about people who lose their memories. But I wanted to do a proper one, because if you lose your memory, then you do get eventually quite depressed. So I had to do this book in a really short space where a woman loses her memory, starts to get it back before the rot sets in. Because if you think about it in real terms, you know, it is quite a frightening thing. It's not a romantic thing at all. So I just had to sort of like just cream off the top of that storyline, cream all the romance and the nice bits off. So it's about a woman who at the beginning of the story is quite jaded. You know, a partner had an affair a year ago and he's done absolutely nothing to repair their relationship, as he promised he would. And the job that she used to enjoy has no longer, a new management firm have moved in, she doesn't enjoy it anymore. The only time that she ever has any joy in her life really is when she does her secret creative writing class on a Monday. She doesn't want to be scoffed at, so she hasn't told anybody. And in this class, she's writing a book about this woman called Sabrina Anderson, who is basically a sassier, more confident version of herself. Sabrina is the woman she wants to be. And circumstances happen, shall we say, the spoiler that I can't talk about anymore. And Polly, she ends up leaving. She's going to leave Chris anyway because she just had enough. She gave him a year to sort himself out. But she has to leave home much quicker, much more unprepared than she wanted to, and flees to this place that had happy memories. But she's only there 2 minutes, and she loses the big handbag that has got all her identity in it. She loses her memory. She falls, she's got a head full of stress, and ends up in hospital. And the only thing she can remember when she wakes up is her name. But she thinks she's the name of the woman in her book. She thinks she's Sabrina Anderson. Which is why that nobody is looking for her and she can't find her identity. So it's from then on, I think that's when the story really starts. And it's about her relationship there with the people who take her in and try and help her find out who she is. And so she's left an unhappy life and become part of a real life, but it's not her own life. And she's really happy there. But then, of course, real life has to come in, and what happens when she finds out who she is. So there was a lot of, wow, that couldn't work in, because readers always write to you and say, well, that wouldn't happen in real life. This wouldn't happen. You know, if you certainly with a brain injury, I had to make it a psychological block rather than an absolute brain injury, because that part of her memory would have gone forever. She would never get it back. But as a neurological specialist told me, if it's a psychological block, anything goes, which was like manna from heaven for a writer, you know, because you can write whatever you like. But, you know, there's a lot of tangents going off here. The whole handbag thing, when she loses a handbag, and there's a gang of criminals who are, one in particular, is trying to get the handbag back. And I loved all that. And that gave birth to a load of seagulls flying in. And so what I start off with, quite a simple plot, always ends up far more complicated. But the bits that creep in on the edges, the complications, are always the bits that I enjoy writing the most. Sorry, my synopsis are longer than the book. I can't do an elevator pitch. Oh, sorry. Go on, Phil. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, all I wanted to ask you was, a lot of novelists who come on this podcast say that the stories they write never really originate from anything they've seen or witnessed, but there's more like a what-if quandary in their heads. What was your what-if quandary for this book?
Well, I'll tell you what the what-if quandary was. My son, who is the lad that you want on your quiz team, you know, he knows everything, right? And when he was little, he used to ask the most bizarre questions, like, he'd wake me up and say, Mum, what's... I wrote them all down. Mum, what's Japanese for ambulance? I mean, why? And then one particular day, he said, Mum, if a lion ate you, would you want it to start at your feet or your head? And you know those questions where you start thinking, like, would you rather drown or be burnt to death? Those sorts of questions where you think... You're actually cogitating it until you get to the point where you think, why am I even getting stressed about this? You know, it was that question about the lion eating your head or your feet first and getting myself all stressed. And the spoiler part of this book, where Polly is in a situation where you think, what the heck would you do in this situation if you couldn't leave? Because that had enormous connotations. Or you couldn't stay, because that also would be a massive, it would be a cataclysmic event for your life. And it was that kind of quandary, what would she do in that situation, that kicked all this story off. What would you do? Because both avenues, both options are horrific.
Really early on in this novel, and there's no spoiler to this, you've written a line for where it says, Polly wondered if that's what professional novelists did, harvest conversations. So do you? Have you given us one of your state secrets?
No, I think all novelists do. You know, we are nosy beggars, really. And people will say to me, oh, if I tell you this, it won't end up in a book, will it? And my kind of stock phrase to that is, look, if it's out of your mouth and it's in my ear, it is my property. But all the time, people, you know, and when I was doing...
Has that worked in court for you?
No, it's never worked in court. It might do one day. I'm hoping so. But a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called The Woman in the Middle, who was about two lovely matriarchs, two lovely women, mother figures in this book. And when I was out promoting it, I was sitting opposite a lady, a lovely lady, who was talking to me about her own mother and said, my mother wasn't like that. And just told me, just unleashed this horrific story of how awful her mother was, a proper narcissist who favoured her brothers, who for some reason absolutely loathed her daughter, and daughter left home at 16, didn't actually know if her mum was alive or dead, but said, I would be really upset to find out, you know, I loved my mum, but I just can't be with her, she's toxic. And I thought, can't families complicated? And this story became my next book, Together Again, about a narcissistic mother. So people deliver these lines to you that settle in your head and grow from a massive seed into Jack's beanstalk. You know, it's thank goodness. So I'm always talking to people, because basically they're all paying my next advance check. You know, I get all my ideas from them.
Be careful what we say next, Nat.
Yes, be very
careful. I was just making me think, I was on the train just last week, and there was a fascinating conversation between two women. I don't want to kind of guess their ages, but their kids were sort of in their 20s. So could be anywhere sort of like 50, 60, 70. And one of them was saying how she was very openly telling her friend that she was going to leave her husband. She had it all sorted out. The husband had no clue what was coming. To be fair, like what they were talking about, it sounded totally justified. I was absolutely on this woman's side. But it's amazing what kind of people share in some spaces that they wouldn't in others. And yeah, you're right, kind of as somebody who's interested in creative writing, and that just all goes in and starts to kind of percolate, and that's where characters come from, I find, as well. So but what I really loved about this story in particular was that notion that we've been talking about already, about how we all, I think, at various points in our life feel like we're trapped. And, you know, I kind of want to caveat this by saying, obviously, there's a lot going on in the world. We all have roofs over our head. We're warm, we're fed. But even so, like in your circumstances, you don't quite feel you're where you should be. Is that something that's always kind of gnawed away at you, Millie? And hopefully you're much more content about that state of affairs in your own life now?
There was a point when I was married, very unhappily so, and I couldn't see a way out. I couldn't move anywhere. I couldn't afford to go anywhere. Couldn't move back home because I had animals and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do with them. And my mum and dad couldn't have accommodated the animals. And so I was trapped. And I remember just standing there with my head in the corner of this room, just like a naughty child, but because I wanted the security of the corner. This sounds mad, I know it does, but I remember thinking, is this all there is? Is this all there is to my life? Is this all there will ever be? Because I think at that point, if someone had said, That's it. That's what your life is going to be like from now on. I don't know where I would have gone with that. I was so incredibly unhappy. And I know from having made a few tweaks, from having stretched out and done the things that I most feared of, like leaving a relationship, that it's never as bad, it's never as enormous as you think it's going to be. It's big and it can be nasty. But I know that with a few tweaks, just how much your life can change. When I think back to that, I mean, it must be about 26 years ago, because it was just before I got pregnant. But I just, my life in a few years changed beyond recognition. And I've had friends who have done the same. You know, they married at 19, settled in, and then suddenly thought, actually, I'm bored rigid. I want something else. And have dumped the husband or dumped the wife, or, you know, or they've split amicably and thought, we both want different things, but we both want more adventure in our life, etc. And gone on and had a second blast at life, a renaissance. And I'm surrounded by them. And I think a lot of women I know write to me and tell me about their own renaissances. And in a lot of cases, they've been triggered off by reading what has happened to me in my books. They've left partners, etc. And they want to tell you that they've got this new life because somehow I just managed to nudge them over that line that gave them the bravery to go. I collected all the letters, you know, I keep them, and some wonderful letters, wonderful letters. So it's with power comes great responsibility. You know, words are incredibly powerful.
Does that motivate you more now than the actual joy that you take from the writing process, if that makes sense? You know, authors write because they feel compelled to write, most of them tell us.
It does, but I don't want to preach. You know, if I don't want to write books that are almost a how to leave your husband or how to get a new life. I'm just content in writing the stories. I think if you start writing prescriptive and preachy books, that's exactly how it comes across. I just write a story and people lift from the story whatever they want to lift. They will see something in there. I've had women who've said, you know, I've read about the doormats in your stories and thought, God, what stupid woman, why doesn't she leave him? And then suddenly realise that I'm actually looking in a mirror, that woman is me. And they don't realise that they're in these sort of relationships until they read about them objectively. And then they make changes. So I just write a story and I'm quite happy doing that. And because people will take from it what they will.
Although How to Leave Your Husband will be a great title for a book.
Oh, the amount, I've had so many of those with the last book. At the first signing I did in Barnsley, a woman said to me, she said, I left my husband because of you. And I think, crap, I hope these men don't fight. But the stories are comical. You know, the stories are, and this woman without a word of a lie said, I just read your book, she said, and I was sitting with my husband in this cafe before we went up to the hospital. She said, and I was sitting in the fracture clinic by myself. Just this book was going round in my head. She said, and I thought, I'm not going back. She said, and I rang my son and said, can you put me up for a bit? And he said, yeah, I'll put you up for as long as you want. And she left her husband. She was sitting in the fracture clinic waiting to get her arm in a pot. And she never went. And I said, did you go back? She said, no, never went back. I'm having a great life now. That is nuts, isn't it? But the stories are quite potent. But at the same time, as I say, they're comical when they say I was sitting in the fracture clinic.
Yeah. No. But I wouldn't worry too much about it, you know, because they're not actually, she didn't really leave her husband because of you. You were you provided the trigger. You provided the smoking gun. But actually, she left her husband because the relationship wasn't working.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just, I was the straw on the camel's back,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, 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 the light bulb.
And I think what you do so well in your writing, Millie, is that, I mean, there are so many examples. I kind of almost don't want to read these out because I want people to discover this in your writing themselves. But I think what you managed to do so cleverly, which I'm assuming is all very purposeful, is that you weave a really warm, funny, engaging story. But at various points, there'll be a killer line, like a sort of killer psychological line that's almost like kind of that nudge, that sort of, you know, you'll be laying out somebody's life and saying about the compounding circumstances of how they've ended up in this thing. And then you'll just kind of do this one line that just sums it all up. And you're like, yeah, actually, That's so true. Like, am I right in kind of saying how you craft some of those passages?
I think so. I think that occasionally I'll get the line, and the lead up to the line is, it's almost like, I always compare it to the bit in Dr. Foster, where they're all sitting around the table and you're waiting for that revelation. You're waiting
for that.
That's
such a great scene.
It is such a great scene. And it's that with me. It's the sweet. It's the sweet at the end of a really bad meal. You know, it's the tiramisu at the end of a really bad pizza. It's like you know where you're going with it, and you think, oh, okay, I'm gonna drag my reader through a bit of hardship, and then I'm gonna just, you know, give them that. And I love doing that. I'm saving myself up to writing that. I'm building it up to that point, and I love it. I get that from reading, the way I do with writing as well. I'm waiting for that big revelation scene in a book, and when it comes, and I do that with my writing. I love it when I get to that point where, you know, there's a killer line or a killer scene that I want to deliver.
And I kind of say all this because I'm aware that we haven't heard you read from your book yet. We'll get to that in a second, Millie. But I think often, and this is something you're very passionate about, I know as well, your books are romances. They're funny. They're romantic comedies. But some people are just dismissive of that as a genre in itself. And I kind of want to preclude that by saying they're so missing out, because actually there's so much work that goes into this. There's so much craft that goes into this. You know, you're such a skilled writer to do that in the turn of phrase. How is your relationship right now with how romantic fiction is viewed generally?
I think that it's been there's a very big hard wall between our genre and everybody else's, you know, the proper writing, as it were, which is absolute rubbish, as you know.
Yeah.
But it's been built up over the years through misogyny, through snobbery. And I think now romantic writers have just about had enough. Over the last couple of years, they've just had enough. And I think that there is a definite hard chipping of that wall. I think people now who say that romantic fiction is lesser are just making idiots of themselves. Once upon a time, they might have been listened to. But I think less and less people now are seeing that as true. I mean, my books are every bit as intricate as a crime novel.
But you know what's interesting? Sorry to jump in there, is that we've had crime writers who say they feel the same way as you do as a romance writer. And it's almost as if the only people who aren't complaining about their position are literary writers. If you're doing literary fiction.
Yeah. And I,
that would almost mean, that would almost hint at just an elitism, is it? Or a snobbery? What is it?
Oh, absolutely. It is an elitism and a snobbery. But I've read books in my own genre that I have thought, my God, this is like poetry. This is just like poetry. Rosie Walsh's book, The Man Who Didn't Call.
Yeah.
When I read that, I thought, this should be on the literary shelves.
I agree. It's beautiful.
The language was so beautiful, you know, and yet it would be in the romance section. Of course, David Nichols, One Day, is a romance. He will say it's a love story. I don't see the difference. But, you know, also because he's a man. If a woman had written that book, it would not saying it's not a great book, but it would not have got the same acclaim. It would be a little bit dissed, you know, and I don't get it. But I think one of my most famous readers, as it were, was Dave Myers, the hairy biker who's just died.
Right.
Dave listened to every single book that I'd ever written. He loved them. That's how our friendship started. He loved Lee Child as well. There's a certain, I think, opinion that romance is only read by women of a certain age who kind of pull it off the shelves in a supermarket and put it in a trolley with their tenor ladies. And it was so lovely that Dave Myers came out and said, I love Millie Johnson books. Dame Hilary Chapman, the Lord Lieutenant of South Yorkshire, reads all my books. You would have thought that people, she's quite discerning. I'm not just saying this to brag. What I'm saying is that people are discerning. There's some of the newspapers that think, oh, we shouldn't really be promoting those sorts of books, etc., you know, because our readers don't enjoy them. Yes, they do. It's quite possible to read the Sunday Times and enjoy a bit of romance. It's not just people who read The Sun or the tabloids. It's everybody. And Dave Myers, he reads Lee Child and he read me. Why can't you read both? I read Lee Child.
Mm.
I read literary fiction as well. But somehow it's you're trapped in a box if you read.
But you know what I find most baffling about it is that not everybody, but if you ask, I would say 98% of the population, if you ask them at the age of, say, 20, what their life goals are, one of them will be to meet someone to share the rest of their life with. So if that's what we're all trying to strive for in life, why would you not want to read about that? It doesn't chime.
It doesn't chime. And also what doesn't chime is I was listening to Planet Rock a couple of weeks ago when I was driving, as I always do. And I'm listening to AC/DC talking about, you know, having... And I thought, God, why has this never struck me before? That AC/DC, Ozzy Osbourne, all the hard men of rock are all doing songs about love.
They all want to be shook all night long by you, Millie.
Yes, absolutely, with your American thighs, you know. They're all about love. But nobody says to AC/DC, oh, you're a cheesy listen, or you're a beach listen, do they? So it doesn't exactly chime. It makes absolutely no sense. And that's why this snobbery is built up of just a very thick fog. That's all it is. And I think romance writers have had enough. The amount of money that we earn for the industry. And of course, the Sunday Times bestseller list, you can't buy the positions in that. It's not fudge. So if your books are in there, then they are there because people have gone into the shops and bought them by their thousands because they want to buy them. So your positions are earned. So how can that possibly be looked down on? It makes no sense. No sense.
No, it doesn't. And it must be so frustrating because also you know that a lot of the people who sometimes are the most vocal or are the gatekeepers who are not reviewing those books have never read them. They just haven't even bothered to try to read them. So it's born out of ignorance as well, which as a reader, I find so frustrating too. I can only imagine how frustrating it must be for a writer like you.
It is. And I think it was last book, the Together Again, it appeared in the Times in a review. And it was like, blimey, that's great. But once it's in there, other newspapers will think, oh, well, if it's okay, then we'll do it. So it's a case of... And I think it will now. I think that people have just about had enough.
If your readers are finding you and you're selling units and penetrating the top 10, why do you care? Do you know what I mean? Because actually, your own audience are finding you.
That's what Jenny Colgan said to me. Does it matter, Mel? And I thought, actually, yeah, it does. Because it's not just the writers who are getting denigrated. It's the readers. It's the portcullis down. It's like, you shouldn't be reading that sort of thing. And it's that. So it's the whole of us. It's the publishers, the writers, the readers. It's all of us being criticised, as it were.
But you can transpose this to music, can't you? It's almost if you become popular. You know, Coldplay, when I remember them breaking through, I was still working at Radio 1, were very, very cool when they broke through. Then they became mass-selling, and they became the butt of everyone's joke. If you wanted a joke about a naff band, Coldplay was the punchline. And
look
just because they're mass-selling.
Look at Taylor Swift.
Yeah, same thing.
More. And yet I've seen her introduced, as it were, in the press as bubblegum. They think you can't get bigger, you can't get more successful, you can't get more talented.
And more consistent.
Yeah. And yet she's bubblegum to some because popularity, familiarity, I suppose, breeds contempt. It's the parallel of that. It's nuts. I'm sure she's laughing all the way to the bank, you know. But, you know, all reading is good. All reading is good. I particularly hated it when 50 Shades of Grey came out. And it was just, I've never seen our cinema so full in my life. Our local cinema. And whether you like them or not, you cannot take away her success. And there were people who had not read for years who started reading books again. It brought them back into the book world. So, but that, oh my goodness, how dare you? That's ridiculous. That's not real reading. Of course it's real reading, you know? Ah, bonkers. There is a lot of snobbery. But yeah, I think we do care because we care. We just care about books and reading and the whole experience, the whole thing. And we shouldn't at all be denigrated into a lower class of literature.
I used to put my copy of The Times inside 50 Shades so that I was spared blushes when I was on public transport.
That's why you need a Kindle, you see, because they've never seen as many Kindles. All the hats reading it. Pretending they were reading their Lee Childs.
But I think it is, you know, I don't want to kind of dwell on this for too much longer, but I think it's, as my mum is an avid listener to this podcast. Hi, mum. And as I was saying just before we started recording, she adored The Happiest Ever After too.
Has she submitted questions?
She hasn't submitted questions, actually. Well, one of her favourite scenes is one of the scenes that we can't talk about.
Okay.
Because we don't want to spoil it for people. you know the one that I totally didn't see coming.
You didn't? Interesting. I'm really pleased about that. You just think they're going to guess. You know, they are to guess. And it doesn't matter if they guess or not, because I've guessed scenes in books and I've thought, I know what's coming. But at the same time, I've been quite excited about what's coming, you know, because I know what's coming. That's great.
But the thing I was going to say was that I think sometimes with these wider discussions about who reads what and the validity or not that some people perceive about certain types of books, it often boils down to me that actually it's just rude. And that I think there's only so long you can go where you try to ignore that distraction and just get on with your life. And then you actually just have to call it out and go, you know what? No.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my other half said to one of his an antique dealer. He said to one of the other antique dealers once, they were asking how I was doing. He said, oh, yeah, she's number two in the bestseller list. And he said, is that a provincial list? Believe that I was up there, just nudged out down from by Richard Osman in the number one position, you know, because that would not have got on his radar that I, me, could be on the Sunday Times bestseller list at number two. Be a provincial, you know, the Wakefield bestseller list. What, you know, so it exists all the time, and it's just inherent, you know, it's just there. You get it, you know, you get this. Have you written anything that I've heard of, you know? And I don't read those books.
It's also like, what are you supposed to say as a comeback to that? It's kind of like, I don't know, have you not read widely? Are you quite ignorant in your reading? Maybe not then.
We need to compile a list of comebacks, really, you know, a definitive list of comebacks, because but these people think they're hilarious when they say that. You know, you just really want to say just one little word.
Yeah.
you know, it's doing it with class. It's doing it with aplomb and exiting the conversation stage right, that you want to leave them with their mouth agape. That's the lines that we need to collect.
A friend of mine was at a do and he saw somebody from school who was bragging about some successful company he'd set up. So he let this guy do this big brag about, yeah, and I've set this up and we're now turning over millions of pounds and blah, blah. And he just waited for him to finish. And he said, oh, really? Me neither. And he walked off. So you can have that one on him. Can I ask you about, because there is humour in this book as well, which I want to point out. I think it's important that we point that out. Why you decided to, as a device, punctuate each chapter with a correction from the local newspaper. In fact, I've got one. If you don't, with your permission, I'll read one out because I enjoyed these. The Daily Trumpet would like to apologise to Mr. Martin Eagles of Eagles Carpets, Doncaster, for inadvertently printing that he had a vast selection of drugs in his 70% off May Day sale while stocks last 9 till 5 p.m. This should have read a vast selection of rugs. We also have to apologise to South Yorkshire Police for them having to turn out in force to dispel the crowds that had been queuing since the previous evening. So why did you decide to put those in between each chapter?
Well, I think it was the tea shop on the corner. I needed a newspaper in there, a newspaper that printed bloops, because it was a plot device. It would come out at the end. And I wanted my reader to think, okay, what's going on here? And then everything at the end, because I love that. Ah, that's why it was there. I love that moment. So I did that. I littered the tea shop on the corner with these bloops. I really enjoyed doing them.
Are any of them real? Because people collect these, don't they?
They do. And there are a lot that I've taken the actual bloop and reworked it, you know?
Right, right.
Martin Eagles was actually a guy who paid me money to have his name in the bloop, which I collected for Yorkshire Cat Rescue. Ah. These bloops have got so popular, people are now buying them, right? And I sell them for charity. So a couple of books in, and there was, I don't put it in every book, but I put it in books where it is a plot device. But it became the monster that I couldn't handle, to be honest. People loved the Daily Trumpet, absolutely loved it, to the extent that one of my books, The Mother of All Christmases, at the end of it, I introduced the editor. And in my One True North, I take you actually into the offices of the Daily Trumpet. And I've had reviews of the last book, Together Again, which was quite serious. And one of the reviews said, really love this book, but I was really sad there was no Daily Trumpet in it. So it's become
a calling card for you.
It has, you know, and I love it. And in this book, the meaning of, and I'm waiting for somebody to, because somebody didn't get it, and it was in one of the NetGalley, and they said, I don't understand why this is in there. I only ever put it in when it, as I say, it has a place, it has a purpose. And there is a purpose in that book, which may or not be a red herring, shall we say. But it has a purpose, and that's why I put it in. And every time I start writing a book and think, I could put the Daily Trumpet in this, I'm so excited, because I've got them stockpiled. I should actually do a book that is just, you know, fictitious.
Yeah, just the Daily Trumpet, yeah.
And did this come from, you know, as we were saying in the intro, your joke writing days, your Purple Ronnie days? Is that kind of part of your brain always switched on?
Always. But there's a little radar going on like that. But where the Daily Trumpet came from was, I used to live in Haworth years ago, and I used to go out with one of the cricketers there. And they had a match every Saturday, and everybody would pile into the pub on the Saturday night. The Keighley News came out on the Friday, and there would be a reportage of the week before's match. And they would sit round and someone would read it out. And invariably, they always got somebody's name wrong, somebody's age wrong. And so when it started out, they were actually just reading out what the match was all about the week before. But it became more of an interest to see what they'd got wrong. And that stuck in my brain, this all sitting round the pub in a Saturday night, waiting to see what they'd got wrong this week. Because it's a provincial newspaper, and they always do, and sometimes the bloops are quite funny, but they're because some people have got their little bit of fame in a province. It's massive, you know. They don't want that. They really are really cross. That
was that the same provincial newspaper you were top of the bestseller list in?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I think I saw it. Yeah.
Look at us, like, racing away with the time. Shall we hear a bit of The Happiest Ever After? Do you want to sort of, I don't know if you're going to go from the beginning or if you need to set up anything before we hear what you're going to read for us?
Well, there's three bits. I don't know which one you want. There's one of the revolting sister-in-law. Mm. There's one of the introduction to the romantic hero, or there's one of the introduction to the gangsters in my book.
I would like either the awful sister-in-law or the setup to Teddy.
Okay, let's go for Teddy, shall we?
Yeah.
At this point in the story, Polly thinks she's Sabrina, and the lady who's taken her in, her son has an Italian restaurant. He's an Italian. She married an Italian. He's got an Italian restaurant. She thinks, you know, actually, you know, they need some staff. What about if you went down? And Teddy's agreed to see her. So this is the introduction between Teddy and Sabrina. Outside Teddy's restaurant, a well-dressed woman paused, let her dog take a dump on the pavement by the front door, and then moved on, pretending not to notice. But Flick, looking through the window, had. Flick is Teddy's niece who works there. Teddy, she's done it again. I'm going to say something. I don't believe it, said Teddy, rushing to the window. I warned her, if she does it again, I will make sure she don't do it again. Flick, out of the way, darling. Please let me do the talking. He asked his pizza chef, George, to throw him a yellow washing up glove from the sink. And when he caught it, he burst out of the front door. Hey, you lady, I know who you are, Teddy shouted at the woman's back. She ignored him and tried to continue on her way, but a spaniel hindered her by squatting for a wee. And I told you what would happen if your dog did it again, so I'm going to give you to the count of three to turn back and pick it up. The woman didn't acknowledge his count, but tugged impatiently on the dog's lead and they walked on. Teddy scooped up the poop with his glove, and with a pitcher's skill worthy of a place in the World Series Hall of Fame, he lobbed it through the air in the direction of Councillor Sterling's wife. Even he was surprised by his accuracy, because it hit her squarely on a brunette French plot with a horrifying splat. She touched her hair to see what had been thrown at her and screamed when she found it out. Maybe now you don't do it again, Teddy called after her, wagging his dirty rubber glove at her. You animal, I'll have the police on you. That's assault, shouted Wendy Sterling, half shouting, half retching, shaking her head, shaking her hand. And it's a £50 fine for you every time your dog drops a poop here now. And if you don't move it, you'll be wearing it 5 seconds later. I'll make sure you pay up the money. Teddy gave her his best smirk. And that was the moment when the two women rounded the corner. And that was Sabrina's introduction to Teddy Bernetti.
I love that. And also as somebody who I still do the school run with my youngest, oh, like dog poo on the pavement or just like left in bags hanging from trees is so annoying.
Wow, that happened quickly. You very quickly transferred into a caller to one of our radio shows.
My partner once did that to a woman, you know. But he said, I've had enough of this. Not the partner I'm with now. It was years ago, right. My first house. And he said, that's it. But he didn't use a rubber glove. He was so cross. He just picked it up and threw it. And it whizzed past her ear. But I've seen that in it. And that has been in my head since I was 23.
Wow.
We store things, you know.
I've been in the other woman's head a lot longer.
Yeah, she had a close shave there, you know.
I was just looking up, Millie, to see whether you'd done your own audiobook because I was enjoying the voice work that you did for us there. But you've not done it, have you? You've got someone else, Colleen Prendergast, has done it.
Yes. I'm okay.
Would you ever be tempted?
No. I'm okay on short bursts, right? But I actually went wrong there. But my words tumble over themselves. And plus the fact it's taking away, isn't it, work from someone who is a pro. And Colleen has done all my books. There was only one Colleen didn't do. And people liked the book, but they said, can you not get Colleen to do it? So we re-recorded it with Colleen. And audio is funny because if you don't like someone's voice, it can really, it's done it with me. I've been alienated by the voice. So my readers know what they're going to get. And they always ask, is it going to be Colleen again? So I like, please make it be Colleen. And we have Colleen doing everything. You know, why break it if it's not broken? Why mend it if it's not broken?
Colleen's going to hear this and she's going to think, oh, I can put my rates up now.
Her head is big enough as it is. There's so many people who call, and I always copy her in when they compliment her, you know, because it's lovely. It's, you know, she's great. She does all the voices. But Teddy's odd because he's got one of these voices, which is half Yorkshire, half Italian. I've got another character in one of my books who is half Barnsley, half German. And that came from the woman that I bought my ever first house from, Marianne, who was German, but she lived in Barnsley so long. She had this really strange sort of accent where she went from one to other. And it was and again, that stuck in my mind. And so I've got a character in my book, Astrid, who is a 6'4" cleaner. And she has this accent. They're just great fun. I have great fun with the people.
So you did, I think I'm right in saying you did drama at Exeter University.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, because I remember we did chat to David Nichols a while ago as well, and I don't know if this is a through line to many other authors, but people who maybe thought they wanted to be in acting, but then took a swerve and went into writing. Is that quite a commonplace thing, do you think?
I don't know, but it happened to me. That was with me. I realised that I actually liked sitting at a desk. I liked the writing part of it more than I did the performing. The performing part came in really handy because it gave me confidence, and I do a lot of talks, and I love doing that. I love putting little readings, you know, not big readings. I find readings very boring, to be honest, if you've got someone who doesn't do all the voices, etc. But it's really helped me, and I love performing. I get off on being a stage, but learning lines. Oh, a few years ago, I thought someone asked me to do a play. So I did a John Godper play, which was very one line. It was two people, just, you know, and if you don't feed the proper line, you're all over the show. And my stress levels went through the roof. And I thought, this is why I turned down drama. I just don't want to learn lines. I'm much happier writing them.
Yeah, I think I wanted to be an actress when I was a kid. And I did do some of that when I was a teenager. And I really enjoyed it. But similarly, I just get too scared. I didn't like people looking at me on stage. And I think that's maybe why I kind of went into radio, because I could still perform in that way and do journalism and talk to people and sort of feed that part that I really genuinely love. But the thought of people looking at me, really didn't like.
I love that. I love people looking at me, but only when I'm in that author persona. If I was out shopping, etc., it's a totally different thing. It's really weird. It's a flip side. It's a professional face. It's my Millie face, and you know, and I love that. But on a personal level, that's scarier. You know, like it was on the TV doing a newspaper review. I just stopped doing them because it was way too fearful. Way too fearful. And it's also having the confidence as well to, with books, I know where I am. I know that I can talk about it quite confidently. But, you know, you pick your own safe spaces, don't you?
Natalie mentioned Purple Runny.
Yes.
I feel we need to explain that a little bit because when I was very young, I must have been in my 20s, Purple Runny was massive. And almost every greeting card I bought was a Purple Runny greeting card, whether it was for a girlfriend or for a birthday or something. Well, they were everywhere. Can you explain the kind of concept to us? And then I bought so many of them, I feel like I've at least feathered some of your nest.
Right. Well, you haven't really, because I am not Purple Ronnie. There's a misconception that I am.
Oh, here we go.
Not. So what happened was, when I got my first job, I was in the building society. I was left university, totally skint, didn't really know what I wanted to do. Didn't really know what I could do. Mm-hmm. I know what I wanted to do. And I sent my Father's Day card with an ape on it. And it was in the drawer, I kept it. And there was an address of a card firm on the back, Statics. And I thought, I'd always written little jokes and poems. You know, jokes were I loved them, joke books. All my money went on joke books. Loved writing little ditties and things. And I thought, I'm skint, I need some money. I'm going to write off to this card firm and see if they'll buy any of my jokes. I had this idea for a range of cards. There were four-line verses. It was a little owl called Bob. They were called Bobservations. This is where the strength of kindness, okay? The guy who owned the greetings card firm was very, very rich, lived in Holland Park, very rich. And the guy who invented Purple Ronnie, Giles, was also doing okay at this point, quite wealthy. And they were in conjunction. Giles had this idea for a card. Statics were going to print this card. This was right in the early days. So it was really in the right place at the right time. And they decided between them that maybe they could give this bird from Barnsley a bit of work. Because he said, he rang me up, the guy from the card firm, and said, look, we've got an idea for a four-line verse. I think it's going to be really big, but would you like to ghostwrite for it? So you will get the money, but not the acclaim. You know, it will be Giles's name on the back. And at the time, my idea of riches was having 10 quid at the end of the month free for a video, but go and buy a video. And so I said, yes. And he said, if you do the art as well, it's really simple. He said, I'll give you double the fee. I'll give you the art fee as well. So I got 375 quid every time I did one of these cards. I wasn't bothered if my name was on. It was mad. I didn't think I'd get that. So I wrote some of the very, very early Purple Ronnies, some of the cards that I had maybe a concept for, but Giles had written the squidgy bum card, for instance, and because my pal was always going about squidgy bums at uni, but Giles wanted to use his poem, so they would still pay me the fee for squidgy bum, and so I did those for a while, but it earned me quite a bit of money because I never actually realised that this was a job that people did for a living, writing the jokes for greetings cards. It's a bit like when you're watching the TV and seeing the continuity guys, you don't realise that they're all scripted or that someone is writing the scripts for all what you think is the improvisation on some of the funny quiz shows. There are people writing all that and you don't realise that at all. So it was a bit like that. It was a mystery. I never realised that people wrote greetings card for a living, and so on and off I'd write them and get some money back. And years later, when I'd just got pregnant and I was made redundant the day before I got pregnant, I thought, what do I do now? Wrote off to loads of greetings card firms that I used to write Purple Ronnies, any chance of buying my stuff? And they all took me on. So that was the legacy of that, and that bit of kindness. He could have quite easily had plenty of material. They could have turned around and said, no, it's okay, it's all right, you know, ignore her, you know, let hope she goes away, she'll never. But they didn't. They let me in through the door.
Oh, nice.
And that led on to a greetings card career for me, where I made an awful lot of money. And again, the snobbery. When I first started off in writing books, I earned nothing. But the greetings card money kept me propped up. And people would go, you'd go to functions and they say, oh, you're a writer. What do you write? Greetings cards. Oh, goodness me. I was like a license to print money. And I thought, if you knew how much I was earning through this. But those were in the golden days. It's not the same anymore. I hit the seam. I was in the right place at the right time. But that Purple Ronnies were a massive step on my writing journey.
I also want to mention libraries, Millie, because we talk about them quite a lot on this podcast and just how valuable they are. And it breaks my heart to hear them closing. And, you know, my local libraries have had their hours shredded. They're only open on certain days and things like that. But in particular, with your latest book, I saw you putting on social media about The Happiest Ever After, that there was some, I can't remember if it was your local library or which library it was, but there's like a 18-month wait where people have like stacked up now to borrow this book.
Yeah, I know. It was people have sent them to me. And there was one, it was like 12 months or something. And then somebody else says, I could beat that. It was like, libraries, buy another copy for God's sake. I'll send you one, you know. But I thought, how great is that? But the offshoot is, of course, libraries and bookshops, we would rather people bought the books, obvs, you know, but libraries are there. And there were people who go on that and think, oh, sod this for a lark, I'm going to go and buy it instead. Of course, people... there's nothing worse than spending like 20 quid on a book and it's awful. You can borrow it from the library and think, actually, I'm going to go and buy her other books. So there's a nice symbiotic relationship that exists between libraries and bookshops and authors and readers, etc. We should always preserve the libraries. They've had to evolve, of course, over the years and not just become a place where you borrow books from. You know, there are meeting places, and certainly our local library, in conjunction with the council, have just put on a wonderful book festival, Barnsley Book Fest. And again, you know, I've had my snobbery all my life. Not only am I being, you know, prejudiced against because I'm a woman, because I'm a romance writer, but my God, I have the affront to come from Barnsley. You know, Barnsley was one of the few places that ripped down an old library and put up a multi-million pound library in its place. Nobody was talking about that, you know. Certainly in Barnsley, we have an awful lot of writers and artists and sculptors per square foot. It's quite uncanny. But if you say to somebody who comes from Barnsley, you can't be a best-selling novelist, you're obviously on a provincial list somewhere, you know. So I've had it all my life, so I'm always battling. But
I'm aware that our time's going to run out soon, Millie, and seeing as one of my cats has just popped in to say hi, what's your current pet status? Because I know you love your animals too.
Yes, we've got two rescue cats coming up to 9. I've got a Eurasia dog who is 7, and we've just taken on a little rescue chow. And so we're integrating her with the cats. It's taken a while, but she's there. She just thinks they're very exciting and very sniff worthy, you know, but she wouldn't hurt them. So yeah, two dogs, two cats. That's the present status. It will change, no doubt. I'm always looking and thinking. But we should, you know, we've got, when you've got a nice settled kind of pet status, you should sort of leave it be for a bit. So even though I would love to take another on, I think we'll leave it there for a while.
There's one more question about the book I'd like to ask you before we conclude, if I can. Yeah. And especially this is coming from a male perspective.
Yeah.
And that the first 150 pages, I reckon, all the men that are in it, I would say, this is my word, I would say they're arseholes. And I wouldn't want any of them as friends or in my vicinity, or I wouldn't want to work for any of them. Now, that's clearly by design. So what was the design logic to that? Because there were parts where it made me feel a little uncomfortable thinking, hang on, all these blokes are awful.
No, sorry. I try and kind of even it up, because I think that the sister-in-law and the daughter are far worse.
Far worse, yeah. That's fair.
The daughter is just evil, whereas the boss is just inept. There's also a son who she has, her stepson, she has a real she has a close relationship with him. So I do try and make sure that the women in the books are as even worse. I think the women are worse in my books, because I always think that if you've got a horrible male boss, it's nowhere near as bad as having a horrible female boss.
Interesting.
But no, I love my characters, and I'm not a man hater by any chance, because I think that the men in my book, Teddy is a dream of a man, and Will.
I didn't think you were for a minute. I wondered if it was a device to then, you know, because obviously things then start to improve, don't they?
Yeah. Not at all. It's not at all. I just enjoy. I enjoy having a nice character surrounded by not so nice people that she needs to break up from. But of course, you do need some light in that. That's why I put Will there, because I think Will is a product of really selfish parents, and yet he can see, you know, just how awful Polly's been treated. And he's only 21, but he's really insightful, and he's the one that called out his dad and said, you know, what are you doing? You know, how do you think Polly's feeling? Never mind you. And so I would hope that even though my men in this book are thinner on the ground, that they shine a very bright light.
So Will reminded me of the fool in a Shakespeare play, in that none of the other characters take him seriously, but actually he's the one that's giving the viewer / reader the most insight into the story.
Yeah. Yeah, he probably is, because, you know, he loves Polly, and it's through his insistence towards the end. You know, he's the one that says, can't, you know, this is nuts, you know, we've got to find her. He's the one that is pushing. So he's the strength here, but he is overlooked, you know, because there are much louder, brassy voices. But you know, nobody goes to the pantomime to see Cinderella. We all go to see that is why I have fun with the horrible characters, you know. And they're the ones, of course, that you want to see get their comeuppance.
Yeah. And also my kind of reading of the setup at the beginning with those really strong, mean characters, a lot of them, where it just sort of creates that emotional wall around Polly, where you can empathize with her, that it's so tough to try and break out of that, because they're so overbearing in so many ways that it's a bigger wall to climb over to kind of get where she needs to be. Millie, I am aware that we have just about used up our time. So are there some other books that you would love to recommend to our listeners?
Yes, there are. I haven't got the two that I can flash up and show you, because I've lent them out so many times and bought them again because they've people. But there's a great friend of mine, Debbie Johnson, has a book out called Falling For You. It's a wonderful book about a woman whose house falls off a cliff, basically, with everything that she's got in it. And so she has to start from scratch again. I'm reading this at the moment, which I am loving, The List of Suspicious Things.
You know what? I'm so glad you've mentioned that, right? It's on my list of things to mention to Natalie after we finished recording, right? Because I only discovered it at the weekend, and it's a debut, and it's another Yorkshire writer, isn't it?
It is. It's a beauty. It's about the Yorkshire Ripper, and it's a young girl that decides, for her own reasons, to stop a movie. She's going to solve the Yorkshire Ripper murder. Mm. It's an absolute belter.
I want to say on that one, just how beautifully, I know you said it's a belter, but I think I don't want people to be put off when they hear you say it's about the Yorkshire Ripper, because I'm not sure I'd buy a book just about the Yorkshire Ripper, but it's not really about that, is it? It's more about being 11 years old, growing up in Yorkshire with the backdrop of Margaret Thatcher, milk snatcher in the schools and all the rest of it. It's kind of, it's a very socioeconomic and warm look at kind of youth, isn't it?
It is, and it's a great portrait of that time.
Yes.
Little snippets in it, you think, oh, I remember that from my own childhood. Yeah. It is, yes, I'm mis-selling it there. There's the backdrop of the Yorkshire Ripper and the shadow that he cast on Yorkshire. But it's about this young girl in a family situation. It is an absolute belter.
And what does it do for you? As someone who's grown up in Yorkshire, because obviously I didn't, so I love it anyway, but I'm trusting the portrait of Yorkshire, but you've grown up there and you still live there. What was the extra quality for you?
It's the, you know, there's every bits, the little bits of the language, like, are you laking out? You know, it's like, are you playing? It's little nuggets like that that you can relate to, and you, it's like little Easter eggs. You feel that you're getting a little bit more chocolate for your book.
That's a lovely way of putting it.
Remind us of the title of that one and the author?
This is The List of Suspicious Things by Jenny Godfrey. I think it's about at number two on the bestseller list at the moment. It's an absolute, you know, it's really unusual. It's really singular, and it just drew me straight in. I'm always quite scared of the hyped books.
Yes.
Because sometimes they don't live up to, you know, what you think they're going to do. There are certain exceptions to that, like Dear Mrs. Bird by A.J. Pierce, and the two books that came after that, Yours Cheerfully and Mrs. Porter Calling. It's absolutely brilliant books. And another one was Last House on Needless Street by Catriona Ward. Mm-hmm. That was like, there was a freezer in it. There was a talking cat. There was a bloke who had a little daughter. There was a missing girl. And it was like, what the hell is going on here? But I was so invested in it. And at the end, it was like all the ends just came together and tied up in the most beautiful knot. It was my book of the year a couple of years ago. This, for anybody who likes an autobiography, the long and I'm not, I can take them or leave them, but this by Leslie Pierce, The Long and Winding Road, I took it on a train trip down to London. I just wanted there to be a train delay because I couldn't stop reading this. I read it on the train on the way back, and I finished it off in the bath the next night. Unputdownable. Leslie Pierce has just got fantastic way of telling a story, and her story had me wanting to find people in this story and belt them and also to kiss them. It was the best and worst of people. It's an absolute cracker.
Yeah, I've just started reading it actually, and I'm not that far in, but so far I'm like, she's so matter of fact about horrific things that her family did to her and how awfully she was treated. Similarly, I was like, where are these people? I also want to like cause them harm.
It was testament to her writing that when she was in a school and the nuns kind of threw them out at playtime, they were freezing. I could feel how cold these kids were. It's a brilliant read, absolutely brilliant read. And I'm just reading these two at the moment, ARCs, and I'm loving them, actually. I'm picking them up because there are certain books that want quotes, etc. But this one, Jo Thomas, Love in Provence, nice bit of warmth going on there. And this one by Philippa Ashley, which is called The Second Chance Summer. I'm reading these. They're coming out shortly. And they're just lovely. I'm dipping in and out of them. Because it's their workbooks, but I don't read now books for work that aren't pleasure at the same time because life's too short. And I'm really loving these two as well. So I've got some. Oh, and this, got to mention this one. Sorry, this is my current bath read. Tim Sullivan, the dentist. I've read them all, but I've gone right back to the beginning of these because Tim writes about his detective in this series. He's called George Cross. I'm so enthusiastic about George Cross because he's autistic. He's got Asperger's. So he really pees off everybody around him. He's got this his partner is like, oh God, because he's got no social skills whatsoever. But he is such an incisive detective. It's absolutely compulsive reading. They can't remember what the teacher is the latest one, but they're all George Cross detectives. Fabulous, absolute fabulous.
I also want to pick you up on I think the publishing industry has missed a trick, Millie, because as you say, like it's always so proud about promoting beach reads where, let's be realistic, most people do that once a year if they're lucky. But actually a bath read is something that I look forward to multiple times a week. And it's just kind of squirreling away that half hour, whatever it is, to just like cocoon yourself and get immersed in a book. Love it.
And the nice thing about a bath read is that you can't do anything else. You can't break off, touch your phone. You can't. You are immersed in the bath and the book because your focus is entirely on the story.
I read yours in the bath.
Did you?
Yeah.
So we've had a bath together, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And I, for one, loved it. I'd definitely have another bath with you.
Not very much. It's my concentrated reading place. I use up, I mean, my water bills. Now I'm on a meter, my God, because I top it up and I'm there for age.
Now, so while we've mentioned it, though, so I read on the, it's not a Kindle, it's an iPad. But I won't read, if I've got a beautiful book, as in a hardback that's beautifully designed or whatever, I don't like to read that in the bath because I don't want the pages to wither. So do you read actual books in the bath or do you?
I have read this in the bath.
Right.
I try and be very careful about not do it because I do pass the books on, but it was too good not to read in the bath.
This is the list of suspicious things that you're holding up again,
right? Yes, the list of suspicious things. I didn't want to miss out because I really enjoyed reading it in the bath.
It looks indecent, Nick. That maybe you don't have your bath as hot as me.
Well, trust me, I do, but I was very, very careful.
Right.
Because I could show you some of the. I mean, even look at this one with the with this one here, the dentist. These are all the.
That's
all
what
the,
I'm on about. Yeah, the kind
and
of
they're
dog-eared
all out on
pages.
one side like that. But do you know, I
you get
enjoy
the same effect if you leave them out in the sun, don't you? If you put it under your sun lounger on holiday and you forget.
Absolutely. You know, you can't. Yeah. And the book is to be enjoyed, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I can never find a bookmark. And I know there are people there that will hate me for this, but I do turn the corners.
You're a
down.
Corner turner.
You know, but I enjoy the books, and I think I've bought it. I'm going to read it how and when and where I want. And, you know, they're still readable at the end. They've not melted.
Yeah, same.
And somebody's getting it for nothing, you know, at a charity shop or whatever. So they can read it how they want. But it's my book. I'm going to read it where I want.
I love that. Excellent.
Oh, Millie, thank you so much for the time that you've given us today and for sharing your stories.
It's been a pleasure. I could have spoken to you for much, much longer.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because now, so I think it would be creepy if I said we should all have a bath, because that's those days have gone. Even for a football team, those days have gone. So maybe we should say instead, I'd like to retreat to Betty's with you.
Oh, yes. I would love that, because nobody does an afternoon tea like Betty's do.
Exactly.
It's the silver stuff, isn't it? It's the little kind of, you feel like a lady, don't you?
When the attention to detail.
Yes, the little finger automatically sticks out. So I love a Betty's afternoon tea.
So we've had this happen before on the podcast. And again, like, it's not about us. It's about the writing. It's about the readers. It's about people discovering things. But you were the one for Williams that just brought up that we should hang out with Millie over afternoon tea at Betty's in Harrogate. So what happens next? How can we make this a reality? Because I love a bit of cake.
Because you want to do that, do you? Yeah. Yeah. As you know, I'm not eating it at the moment, so you can have two pieces. But yeah, so have you? Do you know what Betty's is?
Yeah, I do. I've been to Betty's.
You've been to Betty's, fine. Yeah. Okay, so you're across that. It's like, if you're listening, you don't know. It's like it's one of Britain's oldest tea shops, and there's quite a few of them. And I frequented the one in Harrogate normally around the time of the crime writing festival that happens there in July. And so yeah, to hang out there with Millie and get a proper kind of Yorkshire take on a Betty's afternoon tea, I think would be a lot of fun, right? So yeah, we'll try. Well, you're the one that met her. Did you not? Have you not got a deet? You're the one that fixed this up. You can make this happen.
I was also just thinking, like, I reckon, like, Betty's tea room is ripe for eavesdropping as well.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, some of the stories in Millie said she'd overheard there. Probably second only to a train or something. Do you know what I mean? For quality of, you know. Because, yeah, there's something about the speaking voices. They're quite loud to overcome. There's not, to my memory, I don't think there's any piped muzak or anything like that in Betty's, but I think it's more like there's lots of clanking of silverware and steam machines, you know, making fresh brews, that you need to speak quite loudly. And then, yeah, you'll pick up some gems. I went there on my own once for a brekker, and in the space of about an hour and a bit, I heard some fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, snatched out of context. And then what that does, it allows your imagination to build your own story. I was probably nowhere near the truth in my own head, but I was having a lovely time making up these stories based on snippets of sentences. That I heard a great one in the gym the other day. Shall I share this one with you?
Go for it.
Two women, I reckon they were about 17 or 18, because they were still talking about school and exams. So they were definitely still school age, right? And they said, one said to the other, "What about Friday?" And I thought, oh, maybe they're arranging to meet up or something. And she says, yeah, I've not got on to what the vibe is for that yet, so I need to find that out. And what they were trying to assess was, what's the dress code for a party they were going to?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, what the vibe is. And then there was some other phrase she used, and I thought I should have written it down, because it was something I'd never heard before. They were desperate to not wear the wrong thing to this party.
Well, that is, you speak as if this is a revelation to you.
Well, I think it probably is, because I never gave a shit.
Yeah. This is something I think
still
that
don't really.
Probably women take on unnecessarily. But yeah, I've kind of had that throughout. There's been so many things, like, for work wise, like younger as a teenager, like all of that thing. What are you supposed to wear? Like, is it a jeans thing? Is it like, are there some?
Also, you see, I've never
be
really been into
up?
Fashion. Are you into fashion?
No.
Like, do you enjoy that? So you're not into it. So therefore, it is purely a societal pressure you feel to not, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I
like
to look nice.
Less of a shit, mate.
I like to, you know, I like to buy clothes sometimes, but I don't buy them that often. But it is a kind of, I think it's more of that stress of you walk into a space where you're not quite sure whether you're going to fit in based on what you've chosen to wear, which I think happens by default less to men because
there are fewer options. That's
yeah, exactly.
The male uniform is either you're going to go t-shirt jeans or you're going to go shirt chinos. Or if you're going up a level, it's suit, shirt, mm-hmm, no tie. Mm-hmm. Those are your three kind of main, will get you through most occasions.
Yeah.
I mean, in my, probably when you first met me actually at Radio 1, so kind of what was that, mid-20s to mid-30s, I went through a hefty phase of deeply offensive slogan t-shirts. And I thought nothing of it. I thought, these are funny. These make me laugh. They'll make someone else laugh.
Oh, those were the days, eh?
Those were the good old days. And then also I think, and you've done your fair share of this, don't you think shift work impedes that? I've got dressed in the dark on so many mornings before work that it's whatever you put your hands on in it. Colleagues of mine used to lay their clothes out the night before, so they didn't have that error.
Yeah, that's exactly. If I was ever doing an early shift, a sort of 4 a.m. or staying up late, I would absolutely get my clothes out before. But that's mainly because I didn't want that panic at that time of day about, what am I supposed to? Yeah.
Anything's panicky at that time of the morning, isn't it?
Yeah. And just to take away one decision that I didn't need to make, other than drink some coffee, have some breakfast, get going.
Get out of the house. Yeah. Anyway, Millie's a delight, isn't she? That's the main takeaway from that. Yeah. Not what t-shirts we were wearing, wearing, but Millie's an absolute delight and very good fun to speak with. Oh, one more thing I need to mention that before we go is we occasionally plug Ko-fi on this website, which is the option where you can support us and donate a euphemistic coffee, which translates to a few quid.
I'll let you do that because I always do it and I always get it so right. So yeah, you go.
So it's Ko-fi, is ko-fi.com/bestsellerspodcast, bestsellers plural. So I'll give you that again. It's ko-fi.com/bestsellerspodcast. And just this morning, we've received a very kind donation from someone who tags themselves International Woman of Mystery and has written, "This is for the many delightful moments you got me to discover through your recommendations," which is lovely, isn't it? That's really nice.
Lovely.
So it means that we're bringing people to either to the books that we're featuring or to the other books that you and I speak about. So thank you very much for that. And if you'd also like to help us out, all the donations that we get through Ko-fi go back into keeping this podcast on its feet. So ko-fi.com/bestsellerspodcast.
And thanks very much.